Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So before we proceed, will there be any division of time seeing two people sitting at each council table? Okay. Thank you. Well then, as I believe you all know, each side will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask each of you to introduce yourself when you come to the podium, since we are recording these proceedings. And with that, counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mark Aul of the Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Minneapolis, representing the appellant's investor members of the Minneapolis Stone Arch Partners Limited Liability Company. We seek review of the meaning of the provisions of an LLC operating agreement that determine how much the respondent managing member is required to pay my clients to exercise an option to acquire my client's interests in the limited liability company. The parties agree that the de novo standard of review applies, and they agree that principally sections 7.4J and 6.2 of the LLC operating agreement are at issue.
Just for clarification and kind of like the ground holding here, as I understand it, everybody agrees on the facts of the case. You agree that the operating agreement that governs the transaction is not ambiguous, but it's rather how it's interpreted that is in disagreement?
The interpretation is at issue. That's correct, Your Honor. There is a factual issue.
But you do agree it's not ambiguous as far as its terms?
Not the contract. That's correct. I'd like to walk through those two provisions with you this morning, if I may. As respondent admits on page 6 of its brief, our clients invested more than $3.4 million in the LLC, and they are members of the LLC, the entire LLC. Section 7.4J, that you find on pages 59 and 60 of the addendum, provides the managing member with the option to purchase our client's membership interests. It outlines how the option price is to be determined, and it states in the last sentence, in the seventh sentence, I should say, that there is a floor to the option price. This is the sentence that starts with the last word on page 59 of the addendum and continues on to page 60. The sentence provides that the accountants must provide or must determine the appellant's exit tax obligations, the amounts that our clients owe to federal and state tax authorities in connection with the sale of their interests. It provides that the option price can never be lower than the exit taxes. In other words, the floor is the amount that provides that my clients will never be out any cash. They get zero, basically, at the end of the day. And that is what the accountant held here. The floor is only triggered if there's no value to my client's component of the interests. Section 7.4J does not provide discretion to the accountants. It does not provide that they determine or calculate the option price. It only says that they must calculate the exit taxes.
Well, but don't we have to read that with the provision in 6.2B, 8, which talks about the proceeds determined by the accountants to be attributable to low-income units? Because isn't that what really the, is it the basis, since your clients were investing or getting the tax credits for the low-income units? I mean, that seems to be pretty broad language there.
No, Your Honor. That is a statement that is indeed made in the respondent's brief, that my clients invested in the low-income units.
That's not true?
That's not accurate. That's not a factually accurate representation.
Okay, tell me what's factually accurate then.
My clients invested in the LLC. The LLC owns the project. It says so in, if you look at Exhibit A to the agreement, it shows the amounts of money that were invested. It lists my clients as members in both the agreement and in the changes, the amendments to the agreement. One of the clients came in all the way, you know, much later in the deal. And then in section 2.3, it says that the LLC owns the project. My clients do not own the project. Their clients do not own the project. The company owns the project, and we own a membership interest in the entire LLC. That's an important component of your consideration today. It's undisputed, Your Honor, that The investor members must be placed under 7.4J in the same after-tax position, cash position, as if the LLC were to actually sell its ownership interest in the project, and for no less than 100% of the fair market value thereof. It is also undisputed that this conclusion then leads us to section 6.2B, because the sale of the real estate is a capital transaction, and the proceeds of a capital transaction are capital proceeds, and that's set forth on page 44 of the addendum in the definitions. And then capital proceeds are distributed to the members under 6.2B. That again is not in dispute.
Well, it's not in dispute, but it's also not in dispute then that the accountants had the authority to determine the calculation. I mean,
that is in dispute, Your Honor. They have no authority to calculate anything. They have to do three things. Under 7.4J,
it does have the authority then, certainly not the court.
Well, the contract lays out what has to happen. It is a mechanical calculation of monies. So in 7.4J, the seventh sentence that I just addressed,
right,
it says the accountant must calculate the exit taxes. That comes back in the fourth step of 6.2B2. They have one additional task that is in the eighth step, all the way at the bottom of the waterfall, and they have to make an allocation. So what is in dispute is how 6.2B2 works. 6.2B2 contains a cascading set of calculations, also what we've referred to as a waterfall. And the split that's important here is in step eight. It is not at 6.2B2.
And I understand that, but who are you saying has the authority then to make the determination?
The accountants have a determination to make in the eighth step. The rest simply is math that follows. It is not a matter of giving them discretion or they have the power to do anything. Under 6.2B1, the managing member has to say how much is to be distributed, and they have fiduciary obligations as they have acknowledged in their reply to our counterclaims.
So, but what you said is, help me understand where you're going with this, because I heard you say the split that's important is in the eighth provision. And as I read it, the only calculation decisions really are in the fourth and eighth. Both of those are given to the accountant. And the rest of the cascade is, as you suggest, just, you know, pay this, pay that.
Correct.
So why isn't this, as the district court concluded, giving the discretion to the accountants to make those determinations, which are not for us to second guess?
So there is no discretion. The word discretion, first of all, is used three times in the agreement, and it's never used in connection with the accountant. Second of all, the accountant has a determined task. The task that they made in saying 23.55% of the value of the assets relate to the low-income units is not in dispute. We acknowledge that. But what they did was reorganize the order of events in 6.2B2, and that they cannot do. 6.2B2 is very explicit, right in the opening paragraph, the fourth line. It says, any capital proceeds shall be distributed to and among the members in the following amounts and order of priority. There's no discretion anywhere. The order of priority cannot be varied by anyone, including the accountants. What they did, and I would urge you to look at table one, is you will see displayed, that's at pages 30 and 31 of our principal brief. You'll see that they created a split of assets, not at page, at step eight, but all the way at the beginning. They started by splitting the assets. Then they split the debt.
I think I understand where we're having, we're not understanding each other. You're arguing that their methodology was incorrect, the accountant's methodology, but you're not arguing that they didn't have the authority to make these calculations, or are you?
I am. They had the authority to make the 23.
They did have the authority to make the calculations, but you're disputing the methodology that they employed?
Correct. The methodology set forth by the contract exclusively, they could determine that 23.55% of the assets is attributable in the eighth step to the low-income housing units. But there is no allocation of debt, because debt, if you look at the waterfall, is taken care of in its entirety at the first step. So we start with all the assets under 6.2B2 the opening paragraph, it says all assets. Step one, which does not, again, does not reference the accountants, all assets and all debts are then removed. Then you go to step two, does not reference the accountants. Step three, does not reference the accountants. Step four also doesn't reference the accountants, but it's the same number that they used in 7.4J to determine the exit taxes. So clearly that's a number that is determined by the accountants, but it's not a matter of discretion. They simply have to determine what the exit taxes are, which is a matter of federal law and state law. You then go to step seven. Again, no discretion, the accountants are not mentioned. Step eight, the very first time that the accountants have a role to play, that's really something that they have input in. 23.55% is not in dispute. We agree with that. We get 20% of the 23.55%. So that's 4.71% of the assets that remain at that point in time. The accountants rewrote not only the opening paragraph of 6.2B2 by making two waterfalls there as opposed to one. They also, in order to do so, rewrote the first step of the waterfall. They said, instead of deducting all amounts and debts of the liability, they said, we deduct all debt and liabilities of the company determined by us, by the accountants, to be attributable to the low-income units. Again, there's no role in step one to do any of that. The respondent's brief admits at page 30 that the accountant's methodology was not spelled out in the operating agreement. They also admit at pages 28 and 29 of their brief that the accountants were not engaged in allocating the balance of such proceeds, which is the opening phrase of step eight, but what they did was assigning themselves the allocation of debt and liabilities. By step eight, debts and liabilities have all been taken care of in step one. The right column of table one shows you what the effect of this re-methodology is, and it, in our mind, directly conflicts with 6.2B2, and we ask you to correct that as an error-correcting court. Let me move briefly to the bond principal reserves, if you allow me. Entry of judgment in favor of the respondent must also be reversed on a factual basis. The accountants overstated the bond debt, and as I said, they had no role to play in determining what the amount of debt was. It simply gets taken out. They overstated by $5.1 million, as set out in the declaration of Renee Scruggs at paragraph 11. She there states that when you look at the bond principal reserve, it is always applied first to pay off the debt. And what we're talking about here is a hypothetical sale of the entire project, not just the low-income units, the entire project. You then deduct all debt, and all debt includes the bond debt. The bond debt is reduced first by the principal reserves, again, paragraph 11 of Renee Scruggs' declaration, then by hypothetical cash from the hypothetical sale. What they did here was overstate, and she's very explicit about that, overstate by $5.1 million the amount of debt. This is not something that the district court addressed in its order. We did brief it, and it was argued. This is part and parcel of paragraph 60 and 66 of my client's answer, and of paragraphs 79 through 81, 99 and 100 of their counterclaims, and paragraph 3A of their prayer for relief. This is an error that the district courts basically said, I cannot review anything that the accountants did.
But there's nothing in, if there's something in the provision that says the district court has that ability to review, and that's what the members argue, is that what happens if you disagree? There's no provision addressing that, is there?
There's no provision that says, what do you do when somebody cheats? So when somebody gives you a blatantly wrong amount for the debts and liabilities, right? If we assume for a moment that I'm right and that the debt was overstated, whether it's 5.1 or some other amount, the contract doesn't say, well, there's a mechanism to resolve this. It's plain breach of contract, right? You're not allowed to just substitute another amount that isn't accurate. That's a fact question. The district court entered judgment on the pleadings. This is not a matter that you can enter judgment on a matter of pleadings. We said there were errors and erroneous assumptions in the calculations. That is a factual question, cannot be addressed in a motion for judgment on the pleadings. But this outcome is also dictated by logic.
I still struggle with that a bit. I mean, you both agree that the contract's unambiguous. I mean, and on the pleadings, the district court's interpreting the contract.
Correct.
I mean, I understand that if we were to reverse the district court and say, well, you know, some of these things weren't given to the accountants, then the district court, you know, we would remand and there may be factual issues. But I'm still struggling to see how we at this point get to second guess what the accuracy of the accountant's work, as opposed to whether or not the accountants did work that was appropriate for the managing member and the managing member should be responsible for.
So I believe that there's two answers to your question, Your Honor. One is who should be doing what, and I've certainly argued that right. The accountants don't have a role to play until the fourth step, the A step, and then 7.4J and the exit tax determination. I see my time expire. May I answer
Could
your
you go ahead and answer my question?
The second question is, so what does that mean? And we've argued in the district court and we've argued here that the managing member under 6.2B1 has to state what the amounts are and that they've got fiduciary duties to us, right? They have the obligation to provide the amounts. They cannot just come up with other amounts. Here the accountant said the debts are X. We say the debts are X plus $5.1 million. That is a factual issue that if it was not addressed at all in the pleadings, you might not be able to do anything with. But we've said there are errors. And we have provided expert witness declaration that is unchallenged that shows this is what's happening here. There is an error in a number that is not for the accountant to address.
Thank you. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, on behalf of Ms. Seiler and myself and my client, Mr. Flackney, we thank you for your time and attention to this matter. The issue before the court today is not complicated. I'll do my best not to make it complicated. This is a very simple contract interpretation issue. And essentially the question is, did the district court properly
interpret? Would you please state your name for the record?
David Davenport from Winthrop & Weinstein.
Thanks.
Did the district court properly interpret the unambiguous contract provisions so as to give effect to the party's intent as it appears within the context of the entire contract? The answer is simple, yes. If the court agrees with this, which I hope you will, the district court should be affirmed. The issue that I see is an effort to complicate something that really shouldn't be that complicated. These parties did their level best 15 plus years ago in 2002 to anticipate something that everybody knew was going to happen. And they did a fine job of it. They negotiated an exit, and they did so within a complicated finance structure, which is known as the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. Unfortunately, the appellants are now controlled by somebody who was not at the table, somebody who was not part of the deal, somebody who has come into this partnership and is not familiar with the transaction. They have different intentions. Notwithstanding that, they can't undo the plain and unambiguous language of the contract, and it's agreed to. It's plain and unambiguous. And we basically have two provisions, 7.4J, which is this purchase option, section 6.2B, which is the sale waterfall, which will give effect to the purchase option by helping inform us on what the purchase price ought to be. And it seems very apparent from the plain language of the agreement that the accountants were tasked with certain jobs. And section 7.4J is important because when you look at that purchase option, it starts off with some important preamble language. It makes reference to section 42 of the code, that's the IRS code. It makes reference to the credit agency, that's the Minneapolis-St. Paul Housing Finance Board. And then it makes reference to the compliance period. And those who are unfamiliar with the LIHTC program would say, well, what is the compliance period? Those of us who are familiar with it can tell you that it is an important benchmark in every LIHTC project that's ever been done in the United States across every state in this nation because it determines when the project no longer has tax credits available for allocation and when the credits are no longer at risk for recapture. Okay, so the tax credit investor, in this case, the appellants, came into this transaction and they looked at it and they said, hey, you know what, we'll invest. Because you, general partner, have developed this plan for a project that qualified for an allocation of credits. Importantly, we didn't qualify for a full allocation of credits across all 221 units because we had a 60-40 project, 60% market rate, 40% low income. What that means is the low-income units are rent-restricted, and they are rent-restricted for the 15-year compliance period. We can't charge market rate rents. So what happens? The parties say, I have some credits for sale. Appellants say, we'll buy them. And appellants offer up their $3.4 million or so worth of investment for those credits for this portion of the development owned by the LLC. We're splitting
hairs. And that portion was the low-income units, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. We're splitting hairs when they stand up here on a pen and say, well, we invested in the partnership and the partnership owns this 221. It does, but what we're talking about is how do we acquire their interest at the end of the compliance period? That's what matters. And so we look at it and we say, what did these parties do? They did a really good job of coming up with a purchase option in a complicated arena and said, look, we get to the end, let's just not fight about what the fair market value of the project is. Let's model a hypothetical sale and let's figure out what this thing would sell for if it were to go on the market.
So what I understand they're saying, and maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but is that the mistake is figuring out what the purchase price might be. You know, if it was for sale, you start with, or set out in 6.2B. And I understand them saying they did, step one was done wrong. The first step, the payment of debts, that was done wrong. And if that was, and so the question is, who is responsible for that? That's just a payment issue. And that it should, is the managing member's responsibility, not the accountant's responsibility. Because the accountants had, we're dealing with the calculations in 4, which is the same as 7.4J and 8, but not step 1. So could you just help me with that?
Sure, and I hope I got the question, but essentially, you know, sometimes wrong can be in the eye of the beholder, and just because you disagree doesn't make something wrong. And I understand that they disagree, but that doesn't make their assertion of this being done wrong correct, because they are incorrect when they say he got it wrong at step 1, because his analysis very clearly identifies the debts and liabilities, and at appellant's addendum 76, they identify the bond debt. So this idea that things are overstated, this idea that things aren't there, this is where we get into this deep dive into the minutiae of the details, which frankly, I don't think we should be getting into, but we're not afraid to do it.
But people get to say, come to court and say, I think the contract wasn't followed. And usually at least proceed to some discovery. This was dismissed on a motion to dismiss, as I read the district court's order, because the district court was saying this is the accountant's responsibility, the parties agreed to that, and the accountant's determinations are not going to be second-guessed by us. And that gets back to who was responsible for that first step, as I see it.
Well, sure, and I guess where I would go with that, Your Honor, is when you read the context of the purchase option provision 7.4J in concert with 6.2B, and you look to see what the intent of the parties were intending to do exactly the opposite of what they're saying. They were intending to create a process by which we would give the accountants the necessary discretion to employ the methodology that they saw fit to come to this number that requires an allocation of remaining proceeds that are, quote, attributable to the low-income units. When you start doing things like that, that's going to employ and require necessary discretion. They're not
Well, you're
correct.
Saying that they have discretion. That's not explicitly stated. You're saying that it's implied that they have this discretion because they apply a formula.
That's correct. That's correct.
And so I hear you saying, if I may, because I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, that looking at provision 8 of the waterfall provision, that the phrase determined by the accountants to be attributable to the low income units gives authority to the accountants for the overall calculation, because that's really what this is all about. Is that fair to say?
Fair to say.
And so when you're talking about we need to look at the intent of the parties, that gives us the intent because it's that overall authority given to the accountants, even though it's step 8, not step 1.
Correct, Your Honor. And also in section 7.4J, there's reference to giving the accountants the ability or the right to determine what the option price is.
They're well, I read that as much more being given the ability to identify the floor.
Sure. That's right. And so these.
Well, those are different things, right?
They are, and they work in wonderful concert with one another. 7.4J requires use of 6.2B to get to this option price determination referenced in 7.4J. So I suggest we have to, as the district court said, read them together to give meaning to the ordinary and plain terms in this unambiguous contract. And so when you read those things together in concert and we think about the context of the entirety of the agreement, it works wonderfully well. And it gives the discretion to those disinterested accountants to prevent exactly what's happened here. First, we find a fair market value. If there's a disagreement between the chosen appraisers, there's a dispute mechanism in there, go get a third party, this Lubrock arbitration concept. And that appraised value is what it is, and it's final. And then the accountants need to help us figure out in this hypothetical sale, how much do they get? What is the option price? And so they have to run their analysis through the provisions of the sale waterfall. It's probably not intentional, but it certainly happened, and it happened again in argument by my opponent. It doesn't talk anything at step 8 about giving them an allocation of the partnership's assets. That is not correct. That is something entirely off base. It is a distribution of remaining proceeds when you get there, further divided down to 20% of those proceeds. And that's intentional, and that's purposeful, because they didn't invest in the entirety of the 221 units. They invested in the 40% of the low-income housing units. And so what you have here is, unfortunately, a common effort by a party seeking to do something that they didn't do through their predecessor, which is invest in residual value, invest in the 15-year post-compliance activity of this partnership. They're supposed to go, and they don't want to go quietly into the night. But fortunately, we have a provision in the agreement that says they have to. And the appraiser did his job, and he laid his job out at appellant's addendum 76. And so what I would say is we're done. At that point, we don't have to do a deep dive and start second guessing the accountants, because the parties expressly said they didn't want to have to be here. They didn't want to have to do that. We can disagree, but our disagreements are immaterial, because the accountants make the determinations. They exercise their professional judgment. They do their methodology. They can come up with all these creative charts and moving things all they want, but the simple fact of the matter is, this was ripe for a judgment on the pleadings, because it's the interpretation of plain and otherwise unambiguous agreement. There is no disagreement about that. And so if we are inclined to take a deep dive, I'm happy to do it, right? But I don't think we have to, because we ought not be second guessing. But I would say, just think about it for a moment. What does the accountant have to do to figure out what's attributable to the low-income units? Well, he's got to make a value determination. He's got to say, well, the consensus value given to me was $34.1 million. How much of that value is driven by the market rate units? How much of that value is driven by the low income units? He said it was roughly 75-25. It was, I think, 77-23, okay? Value. Then he said, well, there's another part of value. There's things called costs. What are the expenses associated with creating that value? Well, you know what? He did what I think was the correct thing to do. He said it doesn't cost any more to build a low-income unit or a market rate unit. Construction costs are the same. They're in the same building. Operational costs are the same, this, that, and the other. So he divided out the cost based on the 60-40 split. And so there's a difference between value and a difference between costs. They want to ignore costs and just say, well, he said the value is 23%, so give us 23% of all the assets. Wrong. And they shouldn't be allowed to do it. So essentially where we are is our position is don't second guess the accountants. Don't turn this thing upside down and throw it into a court system where they get to come in on a counterclaim and on a motion for judgment on the pleadings. I'd never seen it before in my life. We get a motion to convert this thing into a summary judgment motion in an opposition to our motion for judgment in the pleadings, and they say, oh, here's an expert report, and they slide that in and say it's uncontroverted. Well, you don't get to create a fact issue in an unambiguous contract with extraneous materials from an expert. Go ahead, I can see you want me to stop.
I'd just like to take you back to my higher level concern, looking at 6.2B. Because I understand you're saying give it to the accountants. I would feel much more comfortable if in either one or two of that provision it referred to the accountants there instead of in step eight. But instead, you've got the provision one, it starts with the managing member shall determine. And then provision two, it doesn't state again the managing member, but it doesn't say the accountants either. It's just this is what will happen. So why wouldn't we read that, reading this provision as a whole, to mean that also refers to the managing member, except where it explicitly gives things to the accountant to do?
Sure, and what the district court did, and which I think was proper, was she looked at section one of 6.2B and said there's the provision in there that talks about after the company's receipt thereof. So the managing member shall determine within 45 days after the receipt thereof the amount of capital proceeds available. Remember, there's no money coming into this partnership. There's nothing that the managing member will receive on behalf of the partnership and say, okay, I've received $34.1 million, now I have to do some stuff. We are modeling a hypothetical event as a means to come to an option price. This is all just out there in a deemed sale as the district court referred to it. So I think the district court correctly determined section one doesn't apply. And then you say, okay, when I'm looking at 7.4J and I'm looking at 6.2B and I'm thinking about the compliance period and I'm thinking about how the LIHTC program works, these parties were trying to say, when I got to year 15, how do I have a graceful exit? How do I have an exit that's structured so that we're not going to fight, so that we're going to have an opportunity to allow professionals to come in, tell us what the appraised value is, let the accountants come in and help us figure out what is attributable to your light to the low-income units. It's complicated, right? Because you had 60% affordable market rate, 40% affordable. These folks did a wonderful job of taking that complicated structure and saying, we'll just let professionals help us with it, and that should remove our disagreements because the professionals are going to do it. But when it comes to fair market value, we'll allow for a third party to come in if we can't come to a consensus value. But at the end of the day, it goes to the accountants, and the accountants make those determinations. So in short, the answer is section 1 of 6.2B does not apply as the district court determined, and we would respectfully request that this court affirm the district court in its entirety.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Your Honor, we previously talked about my client's interests and what they had an interest in. They did not just buy credits in certain units. And I refer you to Index 32, which is our answer, and then attached to is a full copy of the agreement. Page 39, 111, and 133 of our answer, which is specific pages, show you the membership interest in the LLC, our client's investments in the LLC. And then per 7.4J, it is that membership interest that is being sold. It is not an interest in any particular unit. So the contract tells you exactly who's right and who's wrong with respect to that. Two, the accountants, again, do not determine the option price. The agreement sets forth how the option price is determined. It sets forth what the accountants have authority to do, the very limited things that they have to figure out, and that's what we have to follow. The accountants cannot rig or modify the order. Section 6.2B2, the opening paragraph, says it has to be done in this order of priority, cannot be modified. Three, Judge Jessen, you asked about step eight, whether the accountants had the right to make certain determinations. And Mr. Davenport said this means that the accountants had the right to determine the debts and liabilities. But this cannot be true because by the time we get to step eight, step one has already taken care of 100% of the debts and liabilities. If we follow the order of events, you cannot get by step eight back to step one. And it makes a significant difference. If you look at on page 30, our table one, you see the hundreds of thousands of dollars of the difference makes if you modify where you make the split. The accountants looked at cost factors, according to Mr. Davenport. The cost factors are not referenced anywhere in that agreement. It's very specific what you look at. You look at all assets minus all debts. We don't ask for 23.55% of the assets. We ask for 23.55% of 20%, or more accurately, 20% of 23.55% of everything that's left over, all the way at the bottom. All assets, all liabilities, we take our share. Whatever other costs come out, and all the way through step seven, is an amount left. The accountant says 23.55%. We say, okay, you take 20% of that, that's 4.71%, that's it. Then you look at step four, because that's the exit tax obligations, and 7.4J says we get it, both the value and then the exit taxes. The accountant needs to simply recalculate the exit taxes once you decide how this needs to be appropriately done. With respect to the amount of the bond, that needs to be sent back so that it can be deducted from the debt. I submit that you can do that yourself because it makes sense. The that amount of $5 million comes from the financial records. They are before you. I don't believe they're in dispute, but if there is a dispute with respect to that, the district court can certainly figure that out. And that was either a summary judgment or a trial. But it's not a motion for judgment on the pleadings. So our clients have an ownership in the entire LLC. They don't dispute at 23.55%. This is the only percentage ever identified by the accountants with respect to assets. And we accept that percentage. We believe that there are fact issues that have to be determined with respect to the assumptions that Mrs. Scruggs has to make. And so we request reversal and remand with instructions to use only one waterfall, as discussed today, to account in step one for the $5.1 million in the bond principal reserves, to include the LLC's net assets in the capital proceeds that must be run through the waterfall, and to allow us to do the discovery from the accountants and from the managing member to come up with the numbers that Mrs. Scruggs need, or that we all just simply need, or that the jury needs, in order to figure out what that remaining amount is, because my clients, again, have an interest in the entire LLC, not just in the real estate. Unless you have any questions, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for the arguments and the briefs, which have been helpful. We'll take the matter under consideration. An opinion will be issued within 90 days.